Welcome to the Lawyerist Podcast, a series of conversations about law practice. Each week, we talk with legal entrepreneurs and innovators about building a successful law practice in today's challenging and constantly changing legal market. And now, here are your hosts.
Hi, I'm Sam Glover.
And I'm Aaron Street, and this is episode 191 of the Lawyerist Podcast, part of the Legal Talk Network. Today, we're talking with Shannon Montgomery about representing social media influencers and building a law practice niche around your passion.
Today's podcast is brought to you by LawPay, Ruby Receptionists, New Law Business Model, and LawClerk. We wouldn't be able to do this without their support, so stay tuned, and we'll tell you more about them later in the show.
Our friend and multi-time podcast guest, Patrick Pallas, tweeted on the Twitter a couple weeks ago something that I thought was really interesting. He said, "It's pretty clear that our most innovative lawyers are moving out of traditional law practice and into licensing, franchising, or selling services or tech products to lawyers." Teeing up this idea that a lot of the lawyers we've profiled on our podcast or invited to our events in kind of the entrepreneurial, innovative side of small firm practice seem to be doing a lot of kind of side hustle building or building really interesting practices and learning about them and then leaving them. And so I thought it'd be interesting to kind of pose the rhetorical question of what can we be doing to encourage the opposite of that, which is innovative entrepreneurial lawyers doubling down on building really great law firm businesses that grow both revenue, but also take over the legal market with better businesses rather than the best business people leaving law. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how we can encourage that more.
I mean, I have lots of concerns related to this, and I kind of wonder, you know, if there's something about law practice and the way we currently think about it that is just either boring or uninteresting or maybe even unhealthy that makes people not want to focus on it. But yeah, I want to see lawyers doubling down. And I guess the question in my mind, or the question that's maybe in their minds is there just not enough upside to being in law practice? And I think there clearly is, especially if Patrick's right, and innovative lawyers aren't actually innovating within law practice, but are innovating and then just selling products to other people who want to use them. I think there's a ton of, I don't know, blue sky, blue ocean, blue something here.
Yeah, blue ocean strategy. Yeah. Nice business book reference.
I mean, there is so much of that in law, and I want to see lawyers who have it figured out buying it. You know, we've talked about, you and I have talked a little bit about, we're surprised not to see more buying and selling of firms as firms that figure it out start looking around for more business and more clients to integrate into their firms that are killing it while the firms around them are flailing.
My hope is the things we're building in the Lawyerist Lab are going to start contributing to turning this trend, and that the lawyers in lab are going to be building the tools they need to have their practices be the powerhouse firms of the future rather than giving them the tools they need to have different ideas. And there's certainly nothing wrong with being a serial entrepreneur or pursuing your passions, as we'll learn with Shannon. But I think there's a huge opportunity for the entrepreneurial among us lawyers to just focus on building amazing law practices.
Yeah, that's what I want to see. I want to see people like just double down and focus and be amazing. And part of that is just, you know, we've experienced this a little bit at Lawyerist, and I certainly experienced this in my own law practice. You have to figure out what it is that you do well and then focus on it. My uncle is a dentist and he's nearing the end of his practice. And one of the pieces of advice that he gave me was to focus, do what you know. He said, "Look, my friends bring me real estate deals and investment opportunities." And he's like, "And I just turn down a lot of those because what I am is a dentist. I have a successful practice. I'm good at it. I make plenty of money doing that. And so I focus on that." And I think lawyers can learn a lesson from that too, because every time we've gone too far afield from our core competency, it feels like we've come to regret it, because you can't full ass two or three things at a time. You can only half ass or less each of them. And there's a lot of benefit that comes from really focusing on what you do well and then just kicking ass at that thing. And then maybe you just sell it to somebody who wants a turnkey practice later down the road.
Totally. I think one of the tensions that's natural and I understand is, I think the traditional advice around small law firms focusing was around put your head down and just manage a traditional law practice the way everyone does it, because that's the way you manage a law practice, and don't think about all this noise about technology and automation and the internet and marketing, et cetera. And so I'm happy to push harder on that assumption, but I think focusing on growing your business, being curious and passionate about what else is out there and how far things can go, I think is the key to the future. It's not that you should put blinders on to the way the world works. It's that you should use the tools you learn from the outside world to double down on your one best thing.
Yeah. So I guess if there's a takeaway from this intro, it's, you know, do some thinking about what is your one best thing that you do? What is your core competency? And how can you get more out of that rather than trying to do something else? And I'd love to hear your feedback or thoughts in our Facebook group about this or about Patrick's tweet, which we'll include in the show notes. So this week, I'd like to ask you a favor, changing the subject. After you're done listening to this episode, tell a friend about our podcast. And if they aren't already podcast listeners, show them how to listen to a podcast and subscribe to ours. Help us spread the love. Now we've got a brief sponsored conversation with Kristen Tyler from Law Clerk, and then we'll jump into my conversation with Shannon Montgomery.
Hi, this is Kristen Tyler. I'm one of the co-founders of LawClerk.legal, where busy attorneys can go to help hire freelance lawyers when they need an extra set of hands.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for being with us again today.
Hey, Sam.
Today, we're going to talk about some tactical tips you probably already know, but are really worth hearing again for how to stay on task. So, Kristen, you had some in mind. Why don't you get started?
Sure, Sam. So, you know, for me, I find that one of the most helpful things for me to do when I'm trying to be productive, but maybe I have a task I've been putting off, I've been procrastinating because I've just been busy and I haven't had time to dig into it, is something called the Pomodoro technique. A friend taught this to me a few years ago, and a lot of your listeners may already know this. It's the kind of, some people call it the tomato timer technique, but if you haven't heard of it, it's a cool way to force yourself to get started on a project that you're having a hard time digging into. So what you do is you set a timer for, I believe it's 25 minutes, that's what I do, and you just commit. You say, I'm going to focus on this task and this task only, going to ignore my phone, email, everything else for 25 minutes and see how far you can get into it. And I think this really can help if you're having writer's block or just having a hard time getting started on a project, to force yourself to dive in. You're only committing for 25 minutes. If at the end of that 25 minutes, you're starting to flow and get work done and you keep going, you could set the timer again, or you can say, you know what, it's not happening today. We'll try again tomorrow.
Gotcha.
That's one of the things I love, is my tomato timer trick.
Do you actually use a tomato timer?
I just use the timer on my phone. There is a really fancy, cool tomato timer for sale on Amazon if you want to spend a few bucks on that. But, you know, I think we all have.
There are also Pomodoro apps.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'll have to check that out.
I have a Mac app. I think it's just called Pomodoro. Yeah.
Genius. That's great. That's great.
What else do you use?
So another one I do is, if I have a big project that I know I need to work on, maybe I need to work on a presentation that's, you know, for a conference and it's going to take a while to make a handout or a PowerPoint, then I actually schedule it out on my calendar. I commit, you know, 2 hours of time, like a block of time. So I know I'm going to work on it then. My team knows not to schedule anything else during that time. And again, that's a great way to set some boundaries for yourself and your team to make sure you can stay on task.
Gotcha. I feel like blocking off time is a really popular one that nobody actually respects that blocked off time on their calendar. How do you do that?
That's right. Well, it's really easy to break a promise to yourself. Really easy. And I think the next time you're tempted to break a promise to yourself, you need to ask yourself, you know, what if I didn't break this promise? And what if I just actually took this committed block of time to get the project done? It would get me a lot further down my goals for the day or the week. In the long run, you're going to be better served by staying committed to yourself and your plan.
So my technique, because I am terrible at directing my focus, so blocking off time doesn't work for me. Pomodoro doesn't work for me, because there is almost no chance that I can decide that for the next 15 minutes, I'm going to do this thing.
I
call my approach the candy dish, because, you know, like when you get a dish of assorted candy, you're going to pick off your favorites off the top, but you will eventually eat all the candy in the dish, because, you know, once it's left, you know, the Tootsie Rolls start looking good once they're the only things that are left in there. So I try to make sure that I have a sort of a backlog of tasks that all need to get done so that I can pick the one that is most attractive to me in the moment. And I will eventually get them all done, but I always try to keep my candy dish full of things that I might want to be working on at any time. And so, you know, my actual productivity productivity system looks just a lot like anybody else's, but I have just tried to work around the fact that I am really, really terrible at directing my focus. And so I try to accommodate that by giving myself plenty of options.
Well, that's great. That's great. and get the good ones done first. I like it.
That's right. Cool. I think it's important to reflect at some point on whether or not you ought to be actually doing this task. I mean, if you're struggling with it, if you're not finding time for it, maybe you should be delegating it to somebody else.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. You know, you really need to be mindful to evaluate the tasks on your to-do list and to figure out, is that the highest and best use of your time? And if the answer is no, then you need to figure out, can you delegate to someone on your team internally? Can you look at other resources? There's a lot of alternative legal service providers out there, like LawClerk, that you can hire a freelance lawyer to do that research project you've been putting off. You can hire a lawyer through some of the appearance services to go attend a long court hearing for you, where you don't want to sit and wait for 3 hours to make a 2-minute appearance. So there's a lot of ways that even if you are a true solo and you don't have a team, you can outsource and delegate to get those time-consuming tasks done.
And on that point, if you'd like to learn more about delegating through LawClerk, you can go to lawclerk.legal/lawyerist. And there you can get a white paper that talks a little bit more about using the business model of freelance lawyers and ethical considerations for working with freelance lawyers. So check that out at lawclerk.legal/lawyerist. Kristen, thanks so much for your tips today.
Thanks, Sam. I hope you get through your candy dish today.
Me too.
Hi, my name is Shannon Montgomery, and I am the owner of Montgomery Law. I practice out of Texas, but I am not licensed here. I'm licensed in Florida and California, which is confusing for everybody, but it works for me and my virtual law firm.
Is the Florida and California thing why you don't seem to have the thick Texas accent that I would expect?
I really think that the Houston area, which is where I'm based now, it's where I grew up. We just don't have accents here. I don't know why. We just don't. I think it's a huge city. So
listeners, you can decide for yourselves whether or not this counts as no accent, but, so say more about your practice and what you do, because you have a bit of a niche, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So maybe you could say a little bit more about that.
So I primarily work with fitness and social media influencers, specifically in the fitness space, fitness entrepreneurs, so gym owners, clothing brands, things like that, but mostly people who got their start on social media, whether it's Instagram or YouTube, sometimes even Facebook is kind of where they had a jumping off point. And I do intellectual property as well as business needs, and whatever that looks like for, you know, the individual client varies. There's not a lot of consistency aside from handling contracts and protecting, you know, initially their brand and then later down the road their business that they are working to develop.
How long have you been doing this, first of all?
Well, I officially opened the firm earlier this year, so I say January, but I probably didn't really get going until February, March. And I really started because people were reaching out to me left and right online, asking for help with this and that, and if I knew anything about this type of contract, or if I knew what, you know, this person needed to do if they wanted to start a certain type of business. And I realized that there was a huge need in this fitness market, mostly because the influencer space is pretty young and people don't really know that they should have right. an attorney, or that they should work with an attorney, or that, you know, there are legal things out there that could cause them problems. And so I have my own personal Instagram that is heavy into fitness. And so because of that, and it's also sort of branded, which I guess I'll go ahead and say it, it's Lifting Lawyer. And I started that way back in law school. And it was meant to only be fitness. So I would post workouts, talk about nutrition, things like that. But I just liked the way Lifting Lawyer sounded. And, you know, I was in law school and I thought this would be trying to be creative, which is, you know, as it turns out, is really difficult for me. So that's what I came up with.
Speaking of lifting, like, you're training right now for a big competition, right?
Yes, I'm going to USAPL Nationals in October. So it's powerlifting, which is, for those of you who don't know, squat, bench, and deadlift competition. And you do all three lifts, and you get three chances at each lift, and your best numbers is what goes on the board. And it's done by weight classes and who can lift the most, basically.
Okay, then I want to know, what is the heaviest thing that you've ever picked up?
Oh, well.
Any lift, any way, what's your heaviest lift?
Okay. So my best squat is 320, which I'm hoping to beat that for sure in October. And then deadlift, my deadlift is actually not as good as my squat. My best deadlift is 298, and my best bench is currently 168, I believe.
Wow.
And those were both in competition. The squat is a gym record, which in the powerlifting community is a huge distinction. So I must go ahead and make that.
That's awesome. Even in my track and field days when we lifted 3 days a week, I don't think I was on top of any of those PRs. That's awesome.
Oh, well, thank you.
So, not that I should be. I said that like I am some sort of a measuring stick for you, which is ridiculous. So,
no, <you're fine.
laughs> but having been in a gym, I guess I feel like I wanted to weigh in. So you have been active on social media for a long time, and I mean, you have your own following. And so when you say people are reaching out to you online, it must be because you are in the network, the online, the social community of people who are lifting and bodybuilding and powerlifting and things like that. And then you just happen to have tagged on Lawyer. And so something comes up and they have a question. They're like, oh, I'll ask Shannon.
Yeah. And it really started very organically. Now it's a little bit more, I try to let people know that these mm-hmm. are things that I do, obviously, since I started the law firm geared around that. But before, it was really just somebody would happen across my profile and they would send me a message and they would say that. They were like, oh, we just happened to see, you know, we found your video of you deadlifting and then realized you were a lawyer. And now here's this thing I have. Can you help me? So it started very organically. And I mean, I've had the Instagram itself for about 5 years now. And this sort of just kind of started happening last year, really, is when it picked up.
Maybe we should talk about what a social media influencer is for those who aren't really in that world. I'd like you to explain it, but like I even have a pretty brief acquaintance with it through my own obsession with skateboarding has led me to Instagram and YouTube. So I think I understand it, but I think you probably understand it much better. So maybe you could help us understand what that really is.
Okay. It's really pretty simple. And if you talk to a lot of people who are deemed influencers, they hate the term social media influencer, but it is what it is.
It's like you're a thought leader until you actually are one, and then you stop talking about being a thought leader.
Exactly. So there are people who, and for me, it's everybody in the fitness space, right? But they are like, for you, skateboarders. There are people in the beauty industry, people in the foodie industry, and it is people who start their profiles, whether it's Instagram or maybe they're making YouTube videos, and essentially just they come across on the internet really well. People like what they're saying, like what they're posting, start following them, and they amass these. Some people have upwards of 1 million followers. Some of them are more micro level, which the micro influencer makes me laugh because you still have about 10,000 followers, which to be honest is a lot
right.
of people looking at what you're doing every day and listening to you, taking advice from you, you know, wanting to know what you're doing in your daily life. And it's really just keeping people updated on that. And I think a lot of influencers, it was sort of a happy accident. Now, some influencers are more contrived. There are ways to grow your Instagram following and things of that nature. But the more, I guess, the people that I've been working with and the people that I started following years ago, it was more of an accident.
Yeah.
You know, they just posted the right thing at the right time and started gaining followers left and right. So,
and I guess I would point out, I think that what I've noticed is there's overlap, but it's not, you know, anywhere close to 100% between people who are sort of objectively recognized as good in this area and people who are big on the internet, basically, right? Like
right,
there's
right.
you because mm-hmm. there are some people who are just really good at, you know, 60-second clips on Instagram or less, and they may or may not be successful powerlifters or successful skateboarders or dancers or whatever.
Right.
But they're mm-hmm. able to put together a really good looking clip or a really good looking picture, and then they become really popular through that. And then there may be
yeah.
some professionals who have learned how to do that well too, but it's not necessarily a ton of overlap.
Right, exactly. Which is the funny thing for me, because I have personally years of experience lifting and with nutrition, and I had a brief stint as a personal trainer and all of those things. So I have a really intense background when it comes to health and fitness, and I have a lot of that knowledge. And for me, I did not ever become some crazy fitness influencer. I'm mm-hmm. pretty good at lifting. I do really well when it comes to my competitions. And again, I'm not like, I don't have 10,000 followers. And then there are people who don't have quite the background I have or the knowledge base that I have or the success, but they're great on camera, and they know how to post the good pictures, and they know how to, you know, speak to an audience. And so they do really well. And they're also, you know, it's cool because they bring in people like me to sort of, you know, help their audience out. But the influencer themselves, they're the ones that are just, like you said, good at the 60-second clip and take off.
And I guess what I think is the new thing and the business opportunity, not just the legal representation opportunity, is like, so it used to be that if you wanted a ton of people to see your product, you'd have to go and get the Brett Favre or the Arnold Schwarzenegger or whoever who is recognizably at the top of their league, because they're the ones who the most people are going to see by going to competitions or on TV or whatever. And now there's this end around where a social media influencer may have tens of thousands or millions of followers who are paying attention to them, even though they don't even rank in their sport or anything like that. Or in skateboarding, there are people who are really good at doing circus tricks or dork tricks, and they're just really entertaining to watch, even though they probably wouldn't ever win a competition. And so the opportunity there is like, people have just as many or more eyeballs on them as the pros. And so obviously people want to supply them with products. And then more in your world, they want to take that brand that they already have and try and turn it into a business, which is a little bit backwards.
Yep, exactly. Which, I mean, to me, I think it's the most unique thing about the internet. I know the internet is a wonderful place, but I really have enjoyed watching social media evolve and see how these people have been able to, like you said, build their brands first based off of, you know, one particular skill or what have you, and then take that and turn it into a viable, huge business.
We need to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and I want to keep talking about that when we come back. We'll be right back.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby Receptionists, dedicated to helping you grow your practice one happy caller at a time. From their offices in Portland, Oregon, Ruby's live virtual receptionists work in tandem with their innovative technology to answer your calls live with your custom greeting, transfer calls through to you when and where you want, collect new client intake and messages, make follow-up calls, and more. Delighting your callers in English and Spanish just like an in-house receptionist at a fraction of the cost. They integrate with Clio, Rocket Matter, and Lexicata, as well as the contacts and calendar on your cell phone to easily integrate into your workflow. Ruby can host your local phone number or provide you with one, giving you the opportunity to make dual use of your phone. Call clients using your office or personal number as you please via the Ruby mobile app. For over 15 years, thousands of attorneys have been turning rings into relationships with Ruby Receptionists. To learn more, call 844-715-7829 or visit callruby.com/lawyerist2018. If you're not 100% happy with your law practice right now, chances are you want more. More income from your practice, more fulfillment from your work, and more freedom to enjoy your life. There's a new law business model that is allowing passionate attorneys to reclaim their lives and love practicing law again. Alexis Neely has been training lawyers for over a decade on the new law business model she created to build her own million-dollar law practice. And now, the lawyers she has trained in that new law business model have their own high six- and seven-figure law practices, all without sacrificing time with their families and only working with clients they love to serve. It is possible to experience the exhilaration of a thriving law practice, do the most meaningful legal work, have a real impact in your clients' lives, and have complete control over your schedule. Discover this new law business model now by watching the free video workshop series at newlawbusinessmodel.com/lawyerist. Did you know that attorneys who accept online payments get paid 39% faster on average than those who use traditional payment methods? With LawPay, the only payment solution offered through the ABA Advantage Program, you can easily accept client payments online, via email, or in person. No equipment needed. Visit lawpay.com/lawyerist to sign up and get your first 3 months free. Trust the only payment solution developed for attorneys and recommended by 48 state bars. LawPay.
Okay, we're back. So, Shannon, we just teed up talking about sort of going backwards. When you have a brand and you have an audience, or, I mean, really, you have a built-in customer base, at least you think you might, and now you want to take that and build a business around it. So I'm curious, how do you start thinking about that from their perspective? How do you start teaching them to build a business around their brand?
I guess my first question is always, you know, what is it you want to do? What are you trying to do? Let's look at your options. With influencers, a lot of them go straight to product or some sort of online coaching business, if you're in the fitness realm, coaching, or even membership websites where people can come on there and get information from you that you're not giving out for free, basically. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's always, of course, about assessing the liabilities. Where can we take your personal brand and how are we going to keep that yours? What partnerships have you done in the past? Because a lot of influencers, they make a decent chunk of money working with, you know, as you were mentioning earlier, other brands, you know, showing products and stuff of that nature. So we have to assess what have they done in the past.
Oh, and are they competing, I guess, right?
Yes, exactly. So we have to look into different contracts that they may have signed before getting representation. This is why I do encourage influencers to take their personal brand and turn it more into a business, simply because the contracts that they I've had the pleasure of reviewing are usually very one-sided and not at all good for the influencer.
Right, because at the time, they're probably just really excited. Oh, Nike wants to give me, you know, how many thousands of dollars to wear their shoes in my next video or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and some people that's fine. Some people that's all they want to do. But even with those people, I encourage them to maybe let's look into, you know, obviously let's get your intellectual property protected. Let's make sure you're not signing away your whole life in these contracts. And, you know, like you said, maybe not competing in the future, things like that. So it's really a full-blown assessment of where they are, what do they want to accomplish, where do they want to go, and then figuring out what legal holes I can fill. And of course, I have a CPA friend that I like to, he's also a powerlifter. So he works with them on finances, because that's another area that most people before the age of probably 30 don't really like to think about, and taxes and all of that stuff. And so it's just kind of one giant assessment before we get the ball rolling. And of course, if I catch them after the ball has been rolling, then I come in and say, okay, well, here's hole one, hole two, hole three, let's fill these and make sure they're protected, really, and doing things the right way.
It's interesting because I represented small businesses for a while, and there was a difference between people who started doing things before they came to see me, in which case there's almost always a bit of a mess to clean up, versus people who came to me with their idea and they were ready to start their business. And then we could kind of do everything well and buttoned up and properly from the beginning. It sounds like you are cleaning up a fair amount of messes because they weren't really thinking about themselves as a business before they came to you.
Exactly. Which has been, I think, one of my main goals, and probably will continue to be one of my main goals, is just educating people before, really, so that they know what it is they're doing wrong, so that they don't make those mistakes, so that when they do have that really awesome, powerful personal brand, which is what everybody is striving for these days, you know, and they can take that personal brand and turn it into whatever business they want, it isn't a huge mess for me to clean up. So it's just educating people on really what the law is and how it's applying to them. Most people think, well, I'm just posting on social media, you know, or I'm just agreeing to post about this protein bar and, you know, nothing could possibly go wrong. But the reality is there is plenty of messes to clean up.
I think a lot of them are skirting the advertising rules as well, and disclosures and things like that.
Yeah.
I hear on YouTube, I hear so many people say, we're not getting paid for this or anything. They just sent us this really expensive thing for free, which is compensation. And I always kind of bang my head against the wall. I'm like, that is clearly compensation. What are you talking about?
Yes, that is my favorite. I've actually had a client say they were doing sort of a combination with this one particular company. So they wanted, you know, a post, a shout out in a YouTube video, and then also something on an Instagram story. Mm-hmm. And the client was like, well, for the Instagram story, I probably don't have to say anything about, you know, this being part of the deal, right? And I was like, no. you still need to make sure that you're making the right disclosures. Just because it's going to disappear, or, you know, maybe half of your followers will see it, but not the other half, doesn't change the rules. It doesn't change the law. So let's make sure that we still make those disclosures. That's a huge one for people. They just don't understand it. Or they think, oh, I only have 10,000 followers, so no one's watching.
Right.
Well, that's not entirely true. So let's go ahead. I like to say, let's, you know, better safe than sorry when it comes to FTC stuff.
You mentioned a minute ago that when it comes to accounting, you also work with a CPA who's a power lifter.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this idea that's been bouncing around in my head for a long time about, you are really just doing intellectual property, small business stuff.
Yep.
There is no powerlifting, you know, gym in social media influencer niche, really. It's a collection of things that any small business needs to know in varying degrees. So you've kind of made up a niche. And Aaron and I talked about this back in like episode 101, I think it was, with Drew Amoroso, who also works with fitness gyms. And like it's not a real practice area, but it is, you've created it. And it's sort of like a marketing construct, but it's an authentic marketing construct, like a schlubby guy who doesn't exercise can't go and represent powerlifting social media influencers. So I'm curious how you think about that idea of like, we're a bunch of powerlifters who have specialties who are going to help each other. Like, how do you make that into your practice?
That's such a good question, because to be honest, it was kind of an accident for me. And I always encourage everybody, especially in the legal industry, to find something that they love outside of work and outside of, a hobby. Like, you need a hobby. You have to have something that you can go and do that takes the stress of the day away. And for me, that's always been fitness. I've been a fitness addict, a self-proclaimed gym rat since I was 15 years old. And I never planned on giving it up ever. And I went to law school and I had my times where I couldn't make it to the gym a couple days a week and I would be so upset. And then I got into practice. And my first job was actually in bankruptcies and foreclosures in Florida. So that was really fun. And I quickly realized...
I bet you signed a lot of things.
Yes. Oh, it was a blast. I totally loved it. But I quickly realized that if I couldn't figure out how to combine my love for fitness and, just the health industry as a whole with my skill set as a lawyer, that I was going to slowly die and I would never make it out. So I just struggled. I struggled for years trying to figure out how to do it. And then, like I said, when I started getting, emails and stuff from different people saying, oh, I saw you on the internet, it kind of hit me all at once. Oh, here's a hole in this industry that I love and I can fill that hole. So it's hard to say because you're right. It's not a practice area per se. And when people ask me, oh, what do you do? And I say, I just say intellectual property or small business stuff, to make it easy, because it isn't a practice area. But I think the big thing is that although the law itself is applied the same way, I speak a different language than most attorneys when it comes to fitness and fitness people and personalities. And so it's easier for me to convey, in a contract what we need to accomplish without it sounding too legal, but also without it being too, legally sound, if that makes sense.
Well, right. And the interesting thing, running is something, or cycling is something, that a lot of people from all walks of life do. If you are a runner, and you run in groups, you are going to meet people with legal needs who will hire you. But it feels like there's something a little bit different than representing them on issues that have to do with their running, or that, you're representing primarily people who know you because of powerlifting and want to do something that requires legal work related to powerlifting or fitness or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like, it's more of, maybe it's even less than, maybe a marketing niche isn't right. It's like, there is a tribe and you are a member of it. And people prefer to stay within their tribe because you, like you mentioned, you have the sort of shorthand and you speak the same language. You probably share some values, and it's an easy shortcut to, oh, we'll just hire Shannon. She gets it.
Yeah. I mean, the way, now that you say it, yeah, maybe that is, it's not really a marketing thing, because you're right. Although I guess if one of my powerlifting friends or one of my bodybuilding friends wanted to do something outside of fitness, obviously I would
probably still
help them
business.
Do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But for the most part, everything that everyone is doing is fitness related. And I don't know, maybe this is unique to the health industry, because what I love so much about fitness entrepreneurs is their passion and desire to make everybody around them healthier and make everybody around them, have a better quality of life. And so no matter what they do, whether it's just posting a recipe that, a mom with the three kids and the two jobs can make quickly and efficiently, and it's good and our kids will eat it, so they're healthy. Or, they're creating some high level online course that's going to teach you how to be an online fitness coach yourself. Everything they do it with this desire of impacting people's health. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like maybe within this niche, that's why, all of their businesses and all of their ideas are surrounded by are fitness and health related, as opposed to going out of that and saying, well, you know, I have this big personal brand and I'm a power lifter, but I'm going to start a welding company or something. I don't know, but it could be very unique to this industry.
Yeah. And it seems like that's maybe I'm just reverse engineering Seth Godin's idea of our social tribes, but it feels to me like that's the fundamental difference is you can't really pretend to be a member of someone's social tribe. You know, you can't mm-hmm. fake it as a power lifter. You either walk into a gym and know what you're doing or you don't. And
right.
if you walk up to a set of weights and you drop it on your toes, people are going to be like, no, he's not part of this yet. and that's what makes it, but that's what makes it authentic. And, you know, I was rereading Guns, Germs, and Steel recently and talking about sort of how religion and culture substitutes for those assurances of trustworthiness, right? If you're going to be doing business with people, you need to have some markers of, can I trust this person? Mm-hmm. And if everybody's Muslim or if everybody's Christian, you share some values that allow you to say, well, yeah, this person shares my values. I can trust them. And I think maybe this notion of a social tribe is some of that same stuff. It says, yeah, I can trust Shannon. She gets it. She's a lifter. So of course I would prefer to do business with her than some lawyer across town with a generic website that where they're trying to just be all things to anybody who walks in the door. It kind of makes sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I've never been one to say you should be all things to all people in any aspect of life, particularly in the mm-hmm. legal field, because you cannot be as effective when that's the mindset that you operate under, at least in, you know, that's how I feel about it. So I think finding something that you relate to on a level outside of your professional career. And if you are able to incorporate that into your professional career, it is just going to make you better. And it's going to make you the person that everybody wants to come to, which is really the goal, right?
Of life, of work, of everything. Yes.
Yeah. You want to be well-liked.
And it makes conversations easier if you have a thing and you have people you can share it with.
It's so true. Yeah. And How boring is it if you don't have a social tribe or a thing and that you can talk about or that you can go to or that you can, I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into how I feel about it. But
I mean, it sounds like lifting carried you through law school. And for me, it was hiking and camping and you know, paddle sports and things carried me through law school. And then, you know, I started working and I had kids and I kind of, all of that stuff went by the wayside because I didn't have time for years. And now that my kids are just a little bit older, there's enough time for me to rediscover some hobbies and things. And I feel like I was a really boring person. And bored.
Probably weren't boring at all, but bored maybe.
There was a lot of exciting stuff going on in my life, but it was chores and parental duties and work responsibilities, and having hobbies and having a tribe of people that you do things with is a pretty valuable thing, quite apart from whether or not it can generate business for you.
Right. Absolutely. Which I think is one of the things that I always remind myself at the end of the day, I'm getting to, you know, I met a client at a gym yesterday. Mm-hmm. I get to go to fitness expos and things like that, which is personally so fun for me, but also professionally great because I can, you know, maybe I'll make some connections. Maybe I'll get some business. Maybe I won't, but it doesn't really matter because I'm still having fun. I'm enjoying it. I'm working with people who motivate me and who, you know, get me up every day and get me into the gym and give me the advice that I need. And I get to work with those people. So business aside, personally, very fulfilling. So
what something you just said reminded me of Christina Scalera, who's also been on the podcast to talk about Pinterest of all things. But she spends all of her time going to conferences for like typographers and creative people, not legal tech conferences or legal marketing conferences. And I think she's got probably a similar practice in that way where she spends all of her time with her clients. or people right. who are like her clients, which are also people like her. And so you're pursuing your interests together. It's not the same as, you know, walking up to people at the swim meet with a business card and offering, you know, asking if they've been injured recently. So
exactly. It makes it a lot. I mean, because it is, and I hate saying the word accident again, but it is. I mean, everything kind of happens sort of by accident, because I'm going to the expos, or we call it, in bodybuilding, we call them shows, which everybody hates that, but going to a bodybuilding show on a weekend or whatever and meeting people. And I'm there because, you know, first and foremost, I personally love it. And then the professional aspect of it is secondary, which makes the experience way more interesting and a lot less stressful. When you go to a networking or a legal conference or something, it can be kind of stressful, and it's, you know, you build it up and you make it a big deal and you have to make this connection and that connection. But if you're just going to different events where your clients, I like to say live, you know, if you're in the places that your clients live because you also want to be there, it just makes it much more organic and much more enjoyable.
Maybe we can wrap this up with a reward for people who've stayed with us. Do you know what the deal is with the fake tanner at bodybuilding competitions?
Yes, you have to wear it.
It's like a rule, you have to wear it?
Yes. Oh, oh. I mean, I guess it's not necessarily a rule per se, but you won't win. You okay. won't even get any points, really.
Why?
So, because the tan makes your muscles look bigger and better.
Really? I also heard that it, like, the stage lights kind of wash you out and make you look pasty if you
yes,
wear it.
Yes, exactly. The stage lights will wash you out and make you look like you have no muscle at all if you're not tanned. Hmm. So it's disgusting. It smells really bad. It is thick, and it will turn you 15 shades darker for days.
And it's not like normal fake tanner, right? It's like
no.
special bodybuilding sheen or something.
Yes, exactly. It's why it's so bad. And you can't shower and you cannot wear deodorant, because if you do, it will turn green. Hmm. So that's a fun fact for everybody. If you go to a bodybuilding show.
Does it ruin your clothing?
It does, yes. Yeah. So you have to wear all black. And if you are traveling for the show, I always bring my own sheets with me so that I don't ruin the hotel sheets.
Oh, wow.
It's an interesting world. Yeah. It's a strange, strange world.
So I was in LA visiting friends and taking my kids to Disney World. And we were at a community center for my daughter's friend's volleyball team. And at that community center was a bodybuilding show. And people were outside kind of touching up their tan, and they all seemed to have assistants who were like doing it, you know, like getting in there and like making sure their bikini line was properly
glued down,
properly toned and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have like, do they have like people who are responsible for maintaining it? I assume it's your friends sometimes, but.
Yeah. So it's usually either a friend, a significant other, or each individual show has a tan company that will come in to do all the tan. So then they employ people to do touch-ups. So that is an actual job.
I mean, the touch-up seems quite intimate.
Yes. Oh, it is. Yeah. I mean, it's not, when you're in a bodybuilding competition, you're not really wearing much as it is. So
That's true.
A little, yeah. Yeah. It is a weird world. And to be honest, I don't even know how I got into it. It just, again, something that I kind of fell into, and I love it, but trying to explain it to people is almost impossible.
That is the best kind of thing.
Yep.
Shannon, so thank you for indulging me on that. I have been curious about that for so long, and hopefully some of our listeners have too, but thanks for talking us through social media influencing and lifting and all that stuff, and good luck at your next competition.
And thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Make sure to catch next week's episode of the Lawyerist Podcast by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcast app. And please leave a rating to help other people find our show. You can find the notes for today's episode on lawyerist.com/podcast.
The Lawyerist Podcast is produced with help from Lindsay Calhoun and edited by Paul Fisher. The views expressed by the participants are their own and are not endorsed by Legal Talk Network. Nothing said in this podcast is legal advice for you.